Stephen worked as a life insurance product development actuary at two large insurers before joining Stellenbosch University as a lecturer. He teaches both under and postgraduate courses related to life insurance and has a research interest in mortality and longevity modeling. Carsten is a product development actuary at Momentum Life, focusing on pricing and product development of new retail life insurance products. In addition to this, Carsten also serves as the chair of the life work stream of the ASSA COVID-19 task team, which has led to today's presentation. Apart from product development at Momentum and his volunteer work at ASSA, Carsten likes to go out with friends and talk about complex life insurance principles. Thank you, Carsten and Stephen. You can take the floor.
Good morning, everyone. So this is a little bit like a field trip for me, because when I talk about what happens in the industry in class, the first question I get is, can we get a real actuary to tell us about it? So this is what real actuaries look like, which is quite cool to see. You may or may not know about the COVID task team. So the COVID task team's terms of reference is, it's quite daunting, I think. It covers stuff like conduct retrospective and prospective analysis of COVID to learn lessons and model future risk. Issues around market conduct, and then collaborate with experts to deal with future pandemics and prepare the public policy recommendation. So it's quite a wide range, and Carsten and myself, we're on the life work stream, and we kind of thought we'll come up with a questionnaire to kind of find out what has happened, how did companies reacted to COVID, and then maybe kind of ideas of what can happen in the future. In preparing for this, I did scroll through some of past newspaper articles, and it was a strange feeling, because reading some of the newspaper articles published early in the COVID period, it kind of brought back feelings of quite anxiety and interest and so on. So we thought, to kick things off, this questionnaire was sent out to all the HAFs on a LAC distribution list. Unfortunately, we only got 7 responses in total from reinsurers and large reinsurers. So I've got a bit of a captive audience here, so we've got a few questions later on to gauge some additional insights. But to start things off, and hopefully the technology would work, we were kind of wondering about the presentation and say, well, do you suffer from fatigue of COVID syndrome? And we've got a questionnaire which hopefully would come up. I think, do I need to use this as well? Where do I switch it on? Okay, hopefully it doesn't cause feedback. Okay, so I'm not going to repeat what I said, but can we get the questionnaire, please? Ah, there you go. So if you either scroll, I don't know if you can get the QR code, or go to slido.com. the bottom, and then use the waves of uncertainty hashtag to access this questionnaire, and we hopefully it will update. Hopefully that's not just a screenshot of the questionnaire. Is it? Ah, there you go. Okay, so a few people are going to be on Instagram, but it seems like most of you are interested in what we're going to say. So if you guys can keep this open, because we do have 2 more questions coming on later in the questionnaire. And by the way, if some of you can't get on, this is freeway, so we've got a limit on the total number of people. But anyways, there we go. Okay, next slide. Next slide, please. So we saw the Winston Churchill quote, and like most things in almost like research, and particularly COVID research, can we get the next slide, please? It was very difficult to know who originally said this, but you would have heard this before. Those that fail to learn from the history are doomed to repeat it. So we're busy trying to learn from history. I guess I can paste this as well. There you go. Sorry, it's my fault. So as I said, the idea is to review what's been done and get some feedback on kind of where are we going to. We got a fairly lengthy questionnaire out there. In our presentation, we're going to highlight a few things that we found interesting and maybe areas where there were some differences in the responses. We sent it out in April, and that's maybe part of the problem why our response rate was so low, and we got 7 responses. Our hope is that although it's only 7 responses, it is reflects the thinking that went on in the various companies, so at least it's kind of the thinking of more than just 7 people. That's our hope, at least. We haven't engaged post the survey with our respondents, so this is just based on their responses. The last point there is it was collated and summarized by me. One of the concerns that was raised up front was issues around competition commission and the raid and so on. So unfortunately, the detail and some of the questions we had to chuck out. We got some legal advice on that. They kind of thought that somebody independent, and that happened to be me, had to summarize it. So none of the task team had any access to the detailed responses, and it was essentially based on the summaries that I've provided. And I think on that, Gosten, it's over to you.
Quite difficult not speaking with a screen in front of me, so I'm just going to click through the slides on this side so that I can also see the slides. So pressing the wrong button, no. There we go. Okay, so I'm sure this graph needs no introduction to most of you. Most of us kept a close eye on this graph throughout the pandemic, and still keeping a close eye on it now, looking forward. But nevertheless, they deserve quite a lot of credit for what they've done. So, so this is the SAMRC excess deaths, and I'll use it as a backbone when. As a timeline, when I take you through different points in the pandemic. Okay, so if I take you back to November 2019, at that point, none of us knew about COVID, and the first case first case occurred in China. So the Chinese government played it down, and we were none the wiser. So, at this point, only two of the 7 respondents had pandemic reserves actually set up, apart from the bit of protection that we get from compulsory margins in reserves. Apart from that, they also had the protection from in the capital from the SCR shocks. So, not much. By way of protection at this point. Sorry, this button is a bit slow. Okay, so then if we move forward to March of 2020, then we had our first case in South Africa, and insurers started jumping to give solutions to, first of all, onboarding clients, and second of all, keeping their clients on the books. So from an underwriting perspective, we had 5 out of 6 respondents said that they actually relaxed their underwriting requirements and then fulfilled it at a later point in time. So just keep, making sure that they still got the business on the books. From keeping business on the books, or yeah, rather keeping business on the books, they premiums insurers jumped to give clients premium relief. So through premium relief measures such as offering clients to reduce the cover to premium payback periods for 3 to 6 months, that all happened within April and May. So a really quick response showing how agile our industry really is. An interesting note for the premium relief measures is by the end of 2020 they've already been removed. Probably because at that point insurers has already seen that clients have now started valuing their life insurance much more, and that lapsing isn't such a problem as we thought it was at the start. Okay, so then moving on a bit, now we had to set up reserves, and obviously it was much more difficult to set up reserves at this point. Between April and September, most of our responses have set up reserves explicitly for COVID-19. And at this point, they haven't had a lot of internal experience, obviously. So it was quite difficult. So some of them used infection fatality rates and attack rates from other countries. But at this point also, there was no vaccine rollout plan yet, and no so of course no way to dampen that a bit. So if I can speak to the reserving adequacy, if we look from the start to the end, it looks like we've become a bit better at reserving for COVID. Or is it rather that we've just become luckier and that the later waves weren't as difficult to reserve for? So we started off with two having adequate reserves, then moved back to one, then it became, yeah, we've become better, as I said. And then if we look at where the data became available, this could explain why insurers used what they used. It's interesting that quite few insurers actually use the ASA models and the ASA CSI data to in the reserving methodologies. The ASA CSI data only became available later, only in 2021. In I think it was March of 2021, so that could explain that. The SAMRC data was particularly used a lot, and apart from that, internal data was also one of the main sources. So at the right there, you could see the average rank. So internal data was used most, then SAMRC, and then moving on to the other sources. This, our respondents were a bit biased to the larger insurers, so it would be interesting to see how this would look for the smaller insurers and what they've actually used. And then, just a quick plug for the ASA CSI data. So I'm looking at how many insurers actually use it for the reserving. I'm not sure that everyone knows about it, but if you would like to get access to it, you can either pop us an email, or you can just go to that link there at the bottom. You can also just Google it. So the CSI has quite valuable data from the industry, looking at the deaths from the entire industry and comparing it to the MRC data. And what's quite interesting about it is that the industry is quite a bit higher compared to the deaths prior to COVID, relative to the MRC data. So we could speculate what that's about. We could have an interesting debate. Some of the points that's been brought up there is just that the insurance industry, insured population is working off a lower mortality base, so causing it to be more sensitive to the same movement in in deaths or a similar movement in deaths. Another possible reason could be better reporting in the insured population and just the demographics of the insured population. However, the mortality subcommittee of the CSI has actually looked into that using age as a descriptor in that, and they've isolated the data in those pockets, and they've actually ruled it out as a sole reason behind this. And then another poll. So if we could get the next one on the screen. So the question is, what practically could be done by the profession to make the ASSA COVID-19 model and or the COVID-19 dashboard more useful? So this is a free text one. So we'll just see some responses rolling in. Please, no swear words. It's interesting in these types of questions, it's always it's a call for more action, and then as soon as you'd ask someone to contribute something, then they're like, okay, wait, I'm a bit busy, I'm launching a new product. So yes, more volunteers. Okay, I think we can move on from that one. Okay, so then moving on to March of 2021. At this point, the vaccine rollout plan has just been published, so now insurers can start incorporating that into their reserving plans, which helped a lot, bringing the numbers a bit down. And interesting to see that 6 out of the 7 respondents actually used the vaccine rollout plan in the reserving methodologies. I'm not sure what the other one did. And at this point, it's also interesting to note that at some point in the pandemic, 5 out of 7 respondents has used vaccination status as an underwriting in the underwriting, and later on, most of them have actually taken it away, which is interesting. And possibly one of the comments that we've got, which might be explaining the rest, is that they consider exposure to COVID-19 as just the same as actually being vaccinated. So at this point, you could maybe assume that most people have been exposed to COVID-19. And if they are otherwise healthy in the underwriting, at the point of underwriting, then their mortality would be no different than the general populations. So then the last point on capital requirements at this point became, people started debating it heavily. As David had mentioned earlier, now it's a question of what approach do you follow? Is it appropriate to shock an already shock balance sheet? Good debates that can come out of that. But there was a sort of in our questionnaire, there was also a split half and half. Some people saying that it is appropriate, and others saying that it is not appropriate. Okay, and then I'll hand back to Stephen for the last part, and there's another question for you guys.
Thanks. So I've got literally just one slide on kind of what did the respondents to our questionnaire thought we need to do as a profession. But before we get there, we thought we could ask you guys, considering if you want to manage risk, if you guys can just put that question for us. Pandemic risk, we had a few ideas. Can you rank these kind of from number one to number four? Can't remember how many options there were. Sorry, can't see if this is updating. They tell me the voting is closed. Can you open it up at the back there for us, please? Yes, no? Okay. Okay, so clearly capital ends up at number one there, and I'm not sure what the reinsurers are going to do. I guess they have to keep capital as well, but they kind of pass it back to the reinsurers. So maybe lots of business coming you guys' way. When I kind of looked at this graph, one of the things that went through my mind was, Nassim Taleb's idea that these are radically uncertain questions that we ask ourselves. And then maybe we should have added a sixth option over there. It's one need to look at the risk management, I guess, and how to deal with it and think of the structure of our products. And maybe that's kind of talking a little bit to the added pandemic exclusion. Is kind of our product design appropriate? And we spoke about guarantees, and are those long-term guarantees appropriate? If we can... If I press the thing, we'll go on to the next slide. If I can go back to the presentation, please. So looking into the crystal ball, so to speak, the first thing that we kind of looked at is you'll recall that 2 out of 7 respondents held pandemic reserves up front. This question we worded maybe, the wording is important, I guess, here. So we asked them, did the COVID change your view on your existing reserves? And 4 out of 7 said yes. So we found that quite interesting. I'm not sure what the other 3 were thinking. Maybe they had foresight already. One of the questions around this was, what do we do under IFRS 17? As soon as you, as David kind of suggested earlier, a lot of people have updated their assumptions around mortality, and that will flow through your IFRS kind of provisions. So there's kind of a lot of uncertainty around that aspect. So another comment that was made often was a number of times that the capital that we need to set aside need to take into account that the risks are not independent in the pandemic environment, and the order of the events are important. So Carsten kind of mentioned that one of the big things that the industry was thinking about up front was persistency and how do we keep business on books. And it turned out the lockdown impact on markets and the financial markets kind of was initially the big thing. Then mortality came through. And now the question is kind of what's happening in the future. There are some knock-on effects from the on the financial markets and so on, and what's happening with persistency. The respondents also kind of pointed out that the pandemic was useful in a sense in coming up with additional scenarios of and sensitivities for the authors. And I guess that talks a little bit about how the pandemic played out and at market and then mortality and what's happening in the future. So that helped him in coming up with additional ideas for how to look at the authors. This is consistent with David's comments around mortality. So a number of insurers have updated the mortality assumptions to include some kind of loading for future pandemics, and I've also done that on morbidity. But this is an interesting one to me, at least, that on the persistency side of things, a number of said they have not changed anything on the persistency side of the assumptions. The last point that we wanted to make here is we did ask them, what do you do around about your mortality experience? So the first question was, have you looked at your mortality experience? The answer was yes. And then the next question was, so how do you deal with COVID? And the answer was, oh, we don't know. So maybe we need to get point Ron to help us with these fancy models to deal with COVID. But on a more serious side, I think that is one of the issues that we need to look at is what can and are being done on the mortality, in experience investigations in dealing with COVID. So this last slide, I think, are the 3, 4, 5 main questions or themes that came out in terms of requests, I guess, for help. The one is around long COVID and modeling and analysis of long COVID. So we did ask questions around that. Some insurers said, well, it's difficult to actually monitor and assess because, you know, what is long COVID? So they've used things like fatigue and so on to identify long COVID claims. But a few said, well, what we could identify is immaterial at this point in time. So there's a question mark around that. There was a request for correlation of research around pandemics in general, about long COVID and so on. So there's maybe some work for the research committee to look into, and maybe some of the universities as well. There was a question around can we get some industry experience and maybe ranges of assumptions. Now, you guys, the real actuaries would be better placed than me to think if that's appropriate or how would one go about that. But maybe in the industry experience is possible, and the CSI committee would, I guess, obviously look at that. The input on regulations and legislation, the guidance notes, was interesting because there was a bit of a mixed view and kind of similar to David's response. Some people said, no additional guidance, please. Others said, yes, we need guidance. And others said, well, we don't need formal guidance, but we may want some kind of information note or you know, some tick list, if you like. So that's maybe something that we as a profession can look at. And I think that is it for our presentation. Thank you.
We'll take a few questions. Are there any questions in the audience? Stephen, is the survey still open? No.
So the survey formally is not open, but I guess we can take it back to the task team if it's a bit useful to you guys to maybe reopen it. I don't know. So formally it's no, the answer is no, but maybe we can discuss it and let you guys know.
Okay, I suppose it's a plea from Carsten to say if these surveys do go out, can you please just participate? Because I think it's very useful for the profession at large to get this feedback from the industry. I don't see any questions online.
How could I refuse, Stephen? It's probably more of an observation, but anecdotally I've heard that the industry took like a massive painful hit from COVID claims. And it would be interesting to see an income mapped, so those spikes you have, to see them split by income. to decide whether actually this thing, you know, from a money-weighted perspective, but I think there's still an open question as to why the industry took such a large hit financially. Thanks.
So, David, if I can come back to my previous question just to extend on that. Generally, when we're setting our best estimate basis, obviously looking back at previous data, we'll take out anomalies and spikes and things like that, which would usually, I guess, relate to pandemics and that. And then that uncertainty, given that pandemics by their very nature are uncertain with regards to both time and magnitude, that would then come through in the risk margin and the capital shocks. So if we're starting to put that into our best estimate basis, given that we don't actually have a view of what the best estimate will be, shouldn't there be an offset coming through in the risk margin and the capital shocks? And then also, if we're baking in a level adjustment to mortality, which is not a realistic reflection of what a pandemic would be, because it would obviously be concentrated over, say, 3 years and a much higher impact, annually, as we do our valuations and we're unwinding that loading, should we be holding it as a manual provision and accumulating it so that when we do hit that pandemic, that then gets released against it?
Thanks for the follow-up. I think the answer is no and no. If we are talking about a best estimate and we're trying to include the full distribution to get a probability weighted mean, then that is the right answer for the best estimate. But I think embedded in your question is the view, which may well be true, that insurers are going beyond that, that it's not just to include the best estimate, that there's a desire to add in an additional component. If there is an additional component, then arguably that should be more part of capital. But I don't know that that is the case. And so just including an allowance for infrequent spikes to get to a better best estimate doesn't make it not a best estimate. But I haven't been doing that, so the question might need to be directed to somebody who's set a specific basis to understand. So if it is a true best estimate, then no, there shouldn't be an offset against the risk margin or the capital because it is just a best estimate. If it's not a best estimate, if it's more conservative, there's no mechanism to offset it against the risk margin or the SCR that would need to be adjusted in the best estimate. And then all of our liabilities are forward-looking. So if you have, if the mode is lower than the mean, and so most years there's a little bit of surplus, you can always roll that up into your free surplus, but it is not going to be part of a forward-looking best estimate view. You know, we've done some accumulate reserves, well, not in the last kind of 20 years or so anyway. So it should be as part of the best estimate. There shouldn't be offsets against the capital. I don't think we should be accumulating past good news, but if you don't like that standard formula, it's always open to you to assess that differently, to include that as part of your free surplus, to factor that into your assessment of the target capital ratio, to include their commentary in your ORSA. Those would be the kind of exam answers to what to do. I think they are probably the right answers there. I'm aware that I've basically said no about five times to you. But again, I think I'm talking to what I think should be done, and I think at least sometimes what is done. But if there are individuals wanting to say, well, let's add in an additional margin to that best estimate, then I think I'd have more something to say, like, yeah, I don't know that that is really appropriate. I don't think that's where it should be.
Hi. Just a question from my side and perhaps something maybe that most of you haven't even thought of. Is what is our responsibility from a society perspective to pass on this information to the generation in 100 years' time if truly these pandemics are one in 100 years, to make certain, because I was sitting pre-pandemic having to now come up with the pandemic scenario and the information available as to what was happening during the Spanish flu was few and far between. The insurance market wasn't there, so you didn't really have anything to work off from. How do we make certain that we pass on the circumstances and the learnings to the actuaries in 50, 60, 70 years time so that they have that bank of information? And I guess, is it even relevant, or do we not worry about those future generations to make certain that they have what they need to be able to keep pandemics relevant when all of us are no longer around?
I would say it's very important to pass on the knowledge, and by means or the means that we could use is, first of all, research and research papers that are published. That's what they're going to look back at. And then second of all, data. So we have committees looking into doing research and compiling tables, etc. And that's why those committees are so important, and it's important for the industry to contribute to the data in those committees so that we do pass on this data to later generations. And it's not just kept in one company's data bank and then lost over time.
Thanks, Tracy. You've got a small answer. First, a serious answer. Separately from the work that I've been doing is that for a lot of insurers, the 1 in 200 year pandemic cat risk was smaller than their mortality hits for now. So I think that poses the question that either the COVID-19 was more severe than 1 in 200, or the models might be a little bit wrong. You referenced 1 in 100. Spanish flu, I think, would have killed the equivalent of 300 million people today based on population sizes. Every 100 years, who knows? I'm not going to say what the probability is, but I think it is worth looking at that overall pandemic calibration. I think there is some work looking at that. And also, if you do get asked for data for that, please do what you can to bring it in. It's rough doing surveys and getting a handful of responses. In terms of what we can do to make sure that the knowledge is preserved, I can actually imagine a self-contained system that contains all the repository of our knowledge, and it's fueled by burning all the stories on ivermectin.
Can I just maybe comment on that, since I've got the mic in the other hands? I suspect that 100 years ago, our predecessors did document it all, and as was noted in the earlier presentation, there's very competitive markets out there. So we took out the... what's this 5% loading? I don't know. Just take it out. We don't need it. Our experience is so good. So I suspect that for probably the next 30 years, insurers will be very aware of pandemics because we've lived through it. And in 50 years' time, when none of us are still working, they will start chipping away at the reserves, at the premiums, because the shareholders will say, well, we want more money. Policyholders want cheaper rates. So I have a suspicion that in 100 years' time, anything we learned will have been forgotten.
And Nikki, there's a link there back to the debate this morning around the pressure to get those premiums lower and adjusting your assumptions, adjusting your models, and adjusting your views to get to the answer that is needed right here and now, and it's not a perfect outcome. But, you know, maybe some of those lessons in 1918 were written down on David's paper and pen. So maybe we've got a slightly better chance of restoring at least the data, that we can look at the data rather than pretend to ourselves what the story really was.
I know you are only part of the live work stream. Is there any more insights that came out of the other streams of the ASA COVID-19 task force that would be of interest to life actuaries?
Sure, now you put me on the spot to see if I've read the other stuff, which I have. But I'm blonde, so I can't remember stuff. There is interesting work that's been done on treating customers fairly. There was a work stream where they looked at how companies have responded, and they've looked at areas where there's potential, risk. So that is a report that has been prepared. I think in general, the kind of the big thing was obviously business interruption issues around that came up. That's a report that has been prepared and has been sent to council, so hopefully that will come out quite soon. On the medical insurance side, and I don't know if it's interesting to life actuaries, but there is a process in place, or a process that we've started, to gather data from the medical insurance industry, which will then hopefully will be analysed. Now, as you can imagine, that is not an easy exercise. Lots of NDAs being discussed in lots of detail. But that is the hope, is that we'll be able to get a lot of data from all the medical insurers and then be able to analyse and maybe help us to inform, you know, the long COVID type of questions. So there's work on that being done as well. And then there's obviously lots of interesting views on vaccinations and not vaccinations and so on.
Thank you.